Welcome into another edition of the Dana and Victory podcast, only on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick, he is Dan, and Dan, this is episode number 47 of the podcast.
I'll just say this, February the 8th, 2003, CentOS Center, 47. That's all you need to know.
Well done. Well done. I like it. All right. We've got plenty of stuff to get into. But Dan, I think at this point, the most important thing, the thing that's on everyone's mind is the injury that took place last night at Seton Hall. Matt Stainbrook goes down, clutching his left knee, screaming, writhing on the ground in pain, smacking the floor. He got up. He needed help off the court. And right after the game, it was interesting because Chris Mack came out and said that, you know, we're hoping it's just an MCL strain. And that turned out to be true today. So, you know, they can usually do that ACL test right there on the floor and know right away. So you had a pretty good feeling that it wasn't going to be ACL. But the way things happened last night, it looked like it was going to be bad. And at this point, it would seem that this is kind of best case scenario for Xavier fans. I'd say MCL strain is about the mildest way you can possibly phrase it. A knee injury. I mean, obviously there's different degrees that you can have to this injury, and it's kind of pointless in my opinion for us to speculate because X should be intentionally selling the media on the fact that Stainbrook's going to return for the sake of the selection committee at this point.
Right, and we'll return to this point a little bit later in the show when we talk about where X stands as far as the NCAA tournament goes. But yeah, I mean, it was obviously a scary moment when the injury occurred. I was listening to the game on the radio. You know, it was clear from Byron and Joe what they were saying, that they were extremely concerned. When you looked at some of the comments on the internet, some of the things on Twitter that occurred shortly after the injury, there was a lot of worst case scenario talk, but it seems like Matt's injury is hypothetically relatively mild. You know, he's going to be out for the Villanova game on Thursday, which obviously creates its own problems for Xavier, but they're not yet saying that he's definitively out for the Big East tournament at Madison Square Garden next week or for a potential trip to the NCAA tournament. We'll talk about the implications of that a little bit later. We're recording this on Tuesday, March the 4th. The Musketeers on Saturday, since our last show, the Musketeers on Saturday defeated Creighton 75-69 at CentOS Center. More on that later. And then another one of these quick Big East turnarounds jumps up and bites the Musketeers in the behind as they went up to Seton Hall on Monday. Didn't play too badly, as we'll talk about, but suffered another damaging loss, 71-62 to the Pirates. The Muskies swept by Seton Hall this year. They salvaged a split with Creighton. Muskies overall 20-10, 10-7 in the Big East, still in third place, tied with Marquette, who plays Providence tonight in a huge game. Musketeers tied into somewhere between the third and fifth seed in the Big East tournament. And obviously that means a clear trip to the quarterfinal, which will be played next Wednesday. So Rick, let's start by talking about the Creighton game. Then we'll move into the Seton Hall game and then sort of look at the big picture.
Yeah. Well, the first thing about this Creighton game is it was just a fun game to cover. I had Jeff Wallner to my left, who was writing for the Sports Exchange, and Kevin Goeen for Fox Sports Ohio to my right. And it was fun because fortunately those are two guys who are a little bit older than me, but not old jaded media guys yet. And like, we were all just kind of sitting there talking about the fact that it's awesome to watch Big East basketball at Xavier at the CentOS Center and get to witness a game like that. I mean, having a top 10 team in that arena, having it have 1500 fans, standing room only crowd, the atmosphere that was created and the way those two teams go at it. I mean, Xavier and Creighton seem to be fairly evenly matched talent wise. I'd say Creighton's more consistent at this point because of the veterans they have in their lineup, and they both just give each other terrible matchup issues. So I think, you know, like Mo Egger said on Twitter, if they played 10 times, you'd watch all 10. They'd all be good games. And I'd have to agree with them because this was about as much fun as I've had covering a game in a long time. It was just great basketball. The atmosphere created was fantastic. And I think when you look at Xavier's performance and how well they played and how they were able to pull off this upset, you have to start with one, the intensity that they had, which was just off the charts. And then two, the biggest difference in the game was their work in transition defense. I think they sprinted back and stopped the initial 3-point jump shot that Creighton tries to kill you with. And then they also were able to stay tight enough to thwart any secondary transition attacks. And then at that point, Creighton now has to settle in and run through their half court offense, where they have a tendency to become a little stagnant. Now, if they're making shots still, there's nothing you can really do. But fortunately, if they miss a couple, which they did that night, then you get what you had, which Xavier playing tight defense, Creighton getting a little stagnant, and they kind of were a little sluggish there in the half court.
All right, there's a couple things there to unpack. So first of all, on the atmosphere, we talked a couple weeks ago with Snow about, I think it was after the Georgetown game, maybe, about what some of the best atmospheres at CentOS Center were. And, you know, some games that were mentioned, there were a couple crosstown shootouts, particularly the double overtime one, the Jordan Crawford year. I remember a game, it may have been the same season, when X played Richmond toward the end of the year in what was effectively an A-10 title decider, being a super intense game. The Tennessee game, when Tennessee was top 10, you know, a couple of the Dayton games sprinkled through. I got to say, Rick, like, four of the home games this year have been on that, like, top 15 games I can remember at CentOS Center all time. I'm talking about the St. John's game, talking about the Georgetown game, the Marquette game. And now the Creighton game. And I have very little doubt that the Villanova game on Thursday will be, if the game is close, will be similar. So it was a super atmosphere. And as you said, it was just a great, you know, great game to watch. A lot of fun. I agree with you about the two particular observations you made about Xavier. The intensity level at the beginning of the game was off the charts, as you said. And I thought that it was actually one of the first times all year that Xavier has come out so amped up that it actually held them back. It took X 3 minutes, I think, to score before Justin Martin hit an elbow three. But in that time, they'd only given up 2 points, which against a team as talented as Creighton offensively is good defensive work indeed. And you saw that some guys on the team who were sort of notorious for having a bit of a laconic attitude at the beginning of the game, particularly a D Davis, were really, you know, bubbling over at the beginning of that game. I mean, D made some really uncharacteristically bad decisions early in the game, had a couple early turnovers, but they weren't turnovers that were due to sloppiness. They were turnovers due to trying to do too much. And then, as you say, the transition defense is particularly interesting because Creighton, although they love to run, they are not a traditional rim running transition team. They're not a team that wants to have their guards. They don't send, you know, they've got two guards in Manigat and Chapman who are real quick, but neither one of them really want to take the ball to the basket so much as they want to use the threat of penetration, of a penetrative dribble to find a McDermott, to find a Gibbs, to find a Rogge open for a 3-point shot.
Well, Dan,
and what X did really well was keep them away from getting those threes away, I thought.
Right. And right there with what you're saying, what's the first lesson you're taught when it comes to transition defense from the time you're
stop
a little
the
kid?
Ball.
Right. And this is just one time where you have to basically throw that natural mentality, that thing you've been taught since you're a little kid, out the window, because the truth is you can't sell out to stop the ball against Creighton at all. They are not ever driving in transition to score, as you just mentioned. Their guards are probing the defense to suck you in and only looking to kick out for an open three. And that was the problem in the first game, is X was sprinting back at times and trying to give good effort, but they're sprinting back to the middle of the lane to stop the ball like they've been taught to do against every other team they play. And this game, they were locked in mentally and they didn't have any lapses really, at least in transition, that where they forgot to get out to a shooter. So yeah, I thought that was huge. And you're exactly right about the way Creighton's guards make it so difficult to defend them in transition.
Before we go into the things that Xavier did well, I think it is worth taking a minute to just talk about how good Doug McDermott is, and what a complete what complete influence he has on every single possession offensively while he's in the game. I mean, in addition to being just an outstanding shooter, he's a guy with superb body control. He's a good passer. He sets good screens. He's always active, always moving around the court. And I thought Xavier did a pretty amazing job to hold the guy to 27 points on 9 of 18 from the field. This is a guy that seemed to almost have kind of a subdued game and almost put up 30 points. I also have to say I'm, you know, totally impressed with the way the guy handles himself off the court, you know, during the press conference, his comments after the game. He just seems, I know that he was like taking pictures with people on the floor after the game, seemed to be, you know, he just seems to be a super competitor, one of the best college basketball players that's come through in a long time. The thing that I like about him the most, Rick, is that he is a volume scorer who does not take a ridiculous number of shots. When you compare him to the last several like great volume scorers that have come through college basketball, whether it be a JJ Redick, maybe Adam Morrison, maybe the dude from BYU whose name I can't think of.
Jimmer
Fredette. That's right. All those guys were guys that would put up 25 or 30 shots a game, it seemed like. McDermott does this. He gets his 25 to 30 on seemingly like 14 or 15 field goal attempts a game. He just is so efficient that it makes him just such an unbelievable weapon. And he is obviously he's going to be the runaway Big East player of the year, probably the runaway national player of the year. And it's well deserved, having watched him play a couple times this year.
Yeah, I thought, first of all, when I talked about how fun this game was to cover, a huge reason for that was getting to watch Doug McDermott and Samaje Christen go back and forth. Both of those guys just did what they do. I mean, they both got off for big games, despite the other team playing pretty well against them and doing a decent job defensively. And I thought you're right. I mean, you look at what McDermott scored, and it's like, man, he got off for another huge game. But I really thought both Martin and Fillmore did a pretty good job on him defensively, and I thought they forced him into some uncharacteristic turnovers at times, and then I thought Jalen Reynolds was actually maybe the best defensively against him, but he only had about maybe 7 to 12 possessions throughout the game. I didn't quite catch exactly how long he was on it, but it wasn't very much when you added up the possessions, because it only seemed like it was two or three at a time before he was back out of the game. But no, I completely agree with McDermott. I mean, the other thing when you think back to like watching Jimmer is how many crazy shots he took to try to get this off. McDermott doesn't have to do that. The way he finds his shots and gets his shots within the flow of the offense and while playing with other guys who are good players, but ultimately just solid role players. Like none of those guys, even Ethan Rogge, is only good mostly because of the system that Creighton plays in. I mean, on a lot of teams that would be looked at as a specialty player that you almost can't afford, a guy who's too soft, who doesn't rebound, who doesn't do anything defensively, who just doesn't do enough other than shoot that you can take out of the game too easily. But yet in Creighton's offense, they find ways to get him open looks, and it just kind of works because of the tempo they play and the fact that McDermott's a face-up center too. So they create huge matchup problems for other teams defensively. But yeah, that was just a really, really fun game to watch. And Doug McDermott is one player that I'll never forget watching play live. It's one of those guys that you kind of feel honored to have watched him play a game courtside.
Just we'll slob on McDermott for 15 more seconds. What do you think his upside is in the pros?
I think he's a solid pro. Everyone compares him to Wally Szczerbiak because, well, I mean, we know why, but I think he's better than that for a couple of the reasons you mentioned. His athleticism and body control, he's not a great athlete, but the body control and the way that the way that he uses his body is really impressive to me. I think he gets his shot off really well. He creates space really well, and he's able to create enough off the dribble and able to score in enough different ways that I think he's going to be a really solid pro for a long time. And defensively, he's better than I thought he was. He can't guard a center, but he's not going to be doing that in the pros. So yes, guys are going to be more athletic than him, but I think he'll match up better than a lot of people think. And you hit the nail on the head as far as what type of guy he is. I will say right before the game, he came over and talked to some of the student sections who are, you know, they're trying to heckle him. And I'm sure he gets that at every arena he goes to. So he walks over and says, "Hey, what's going on, guys?" And starts sort of talking to some of the students. And they had a little conversation. And then at the end of the game, when the students were heckling him and he was up pressing, waiting for Xavier to come back out on the court after the timeout, he was guarding the inbound passer. So he was right in front of me and in front of the student section facing them. And they're screaming, it's over, you know. And he just looked at them and gave them a little golf clap and said, you're right, you got us. Like he's like, yeah, you're right. Cause there's only 8 seconds left or something on the clock. And they were down by multiple possessions.
Rick, I thought the story in this game was, I mean, well, it's very easy to say what the story was. Justin Martin came out early in this game and really set a tone defensively and on the glass. And although his rebounding numbers, 15 defensive rebounds, 1 offensive rebound, some of that is a little bit out there because a lot of the rebounds he got were completely uncontested. Creighton doesn't really contest a lot of their misses. I thought he was outstanding from the word go. Hit a three to get Xavier sort of off the boil. But then it was D. Davis, I thought, that really made this team go for the rest of the game. He only took 9 shots, but he scores 15 points. He grabs – he dishes out 5 assists. He has a couple steals, but he kept – but he made several of the biggest shots of the game. He hit a really long three in the first half when Xavier was going through a little bit of a scoring drought and had kind of a desperation 25-foot. At the end of the shot clock, but he hit the biggest shot of the game, I thought, in the second half. Xavier had 2 lengthy spells where they really couldn't score and were holding on in the game mostly because of their defense. And at one point, the game goes from 12-point game to a 3-point game at, I believe, 61-58. And D comes down, makes a nice move, gets into the lane and finishes. And that gave Xavier a little bit of an exhale. And then a couple possessions later, you know, J-Mart hits a big 3 and the Musketeers are rolling from there. But I thought D. Davis was a huge part of this win.
I thought D came up with some of the shots that, quite frankly, we've seen Xavier not be able to hit this year. Some of those shots where things are starting to slip away, or in other cases this year, it's been Xavier's trying to make a comeback and they've got it within 5-6 points and they need that one open look to go in. This time it didn't even have to be open looks. I mean, you mentioned the one where the shot clock was winding down and D gave the guy a little in and out dribble and then just stepped back and nailed that 3 from the right wing. And that was a huge shot. And it wasn't as much about how many he scored. I mean, the 15 points was obviously nice, but it was about how big those shots were. Well, like you said, they were so
baskets,
clutch.
Both those baskets I referenced were plays where D really didn't have any help. He did it all himself.
Yeah, and they were out of rhythm, you know, not a set play or not a good kick out. It was him just kind of, we need something right now. Nothing's going, and bang, he made it.
When you look at the inside guys in this game, there was a little bit of a difference of opinion between you and Snow about how Stainbrook played in this game. Snow's view was that he made some bad decisions. He was a little bit slow in dealing with the double team. I actually come down on your side on this one, Rick, because I thought that Creighton made a very, you know, Coach McDermott made a very obvious tactical decision that they were going to, that they knew they couldn't guard Matt Stainbrook from the first game in Omaha, that the only way that the biggest thing that they could do to slow Xavier down was to run that double team at Matt and put the focus on him and make him make good decisions and good plays. And I thought for the most part, he did. He had 4 assists, 2 turnovers in the game, only at 5 points, but the critical thing I thought for him is that he had a bunch of what Coach Mack calls hockey assists,
right,
where he springs a pass out of the double team and then it's the extra pass to the open man, where he springs the pass out of the double team. All of a sudden the defense has to recover 1 pass and maybe he's got Isaiah Fillmore down in the low block on the other side, or he's got a cutter going to the basket, or you got Justin Martin for a mid-range jumper or something. So I thought Stainbrook played pretty well. Generally though, Rick, I thought that one thing, you know, if there is a downside to this game, I don't think that Creighton would shoot 10 of 34 from 3. Like if against, you know, I thought that Xavier got very lucky because Creighton missed a lot of very makeable shots in this game. A lot of shots that could have brought the game a lot closer in the second half when I referenced those long droughts that Xavier had offensively. So I think Xavier, they did ride their luck a little bit in this game because it's very rare, even with good contesting actions, it's very rare you're going to see McDermott miss 7 threes or Rogge miss 6. And one of the things for Creighton was that sometimes they just made bad decisions. Jens Monagat doesn't need to be taking 7 threes. Chatman doesn't need to be taking 3. They need to be rotating the ball to the guy guys that can knock those down. And a lot of that, I think, had to do with the way X effectively defended the high screens that have bedeviled them all year, and the way they got out on the perimeter to contest shots from Creighton's big men.
Well, again, Dan, I mean, you're right. You have to, and this is what I said right at the beginning of the podcast, is that you have to get a little bit lucky against Creighton, to the extent that if they make shots, there's nothing you can do. I mean, if they're shooting the way they shot last time against Xavier, there's not much you can do. Some of those shots were just unbelievable. I mean, 28 footers in transition from a 6'8 guy. What can you do to stop that, in all honesty? But again, it goes back to the transition defense, in my opinion, because what we've seen from Creighton the few games that they really have struggled to score the ball is that they've been stagnant. And the thing that that goes unnoticed when they're really shooting the ball well from the outside is that they get a team chasing them. And that's exactly what Xavier did at Creighton, is they were just chasing the whole game. Once they got those transition threes, Xavier was running all over the place and never was set up. And what it allowed was a lot of easy buckets off dives to the rim or just quick cuts that you didn't see any of at the Cintas Center. Xavier was back to being their normal tight pack line defense in the half court because they were able to initially stop that transition three, and they didn't get in that chasing mentality where they were just run around the court like chickens with their heads cut off. And I think that's huge, is when Creighton gets that rhythm going and then they're hitting threes in transition and they start cutting to the rim and getting easy buckets in between, they're really tough to stop. But when you're not allowing those easy buckets, they're not getting the easy transition three, they're not getting the cuts to the rim, they all of a sudden take bad threes because you've got Manigat, you know, late in a shot clock hoisting one up. And that's where I thought the big difference was Xavier's defense. Yes, they missed some shots that they normally might make, but again, I think if they're in the rhythm that they got in the last time because of the easy buckets they make, and they're able to continue scoring and they don't have these droughts that we saw at the Cintas Center, then they're a completely different team to defend. And I think that also affects their rhythm. They're a team that likes to play faster. They like to score in a rhythm. And when you don't allow them to do that, they're not nearly as effective.
So Rick, at about 7:30 on Saturday evening, I think everybody's feeling really good about where the Musketeers were. About 49 hours later, things were thrown up a little bit into confusion as the Musketeers made the quick turnaround Monday night's game at Seton Hall. Muskies lose 71-62, but the first half of that game was about as bad. It was about as worst a case scenario as you could possibly come up with.
Yep.
The Musketeers score 8 points in the first 10 minutes of the game. They then give up a hail of transition threes to guys that can't shoot toward the end of that half. You lose Stainbrook to a knee injury that at the time looked, you know, season ending at best.
Right.
And, you know, down 32-20 at halftime. And despite, you know, a superior second half from Samaje Kristen, never really got back into it. It seems like your take on this was that a lot of people, after a loss like this, they go back to some of the narratives that have surrounded this team for a long time this year. And sometimes some of those narratives are valid for the games that were played. But your take on it was that this was not a game that could easily be classified alongside some of the other games Xavier's lost in conference this year.
Right. I'll admit, I really didn't expect them to lose. I knew what team they've been on the road. All right. We've all seen that. But I thought with the way they're playing, what they showed on the road at St. John's, the revenge that was owed to Seton Hall, and the fact that Seton Hall is a team with some talent, but a team that's had guys injured in and out of the lineup throughout the year. They've been struggling with their roles. They just haven't been a very cohesive unit all season long. They've played very inconsistent. I thought this was a game they would pull out. And I still think if you leave Stainbrook on the team for the full game, and you know, they had it down to five a couple times in the second half without him in the game, if he is in there, I still think they have a chance to win this game with the way that they played. And that was my point last night, is that this wasn't a team that failed to show up or wasn't prepared or was completely befuddled by his own defense or didn't run back hard enough on their defensive end. It was a team that came out with plenty of effort. It was a team that didn't execute great, but it wasn't horrible. I mean, they had a couple breakdowns defensively, mostly relating to Brian Oliver and letting him get open for threes, which you just can't really do because he's only a 3-point shooter. He's really no threat to put the ball on the deck and beat you off the dribble. So you have to chase that guy off the line, which I think is what probably, if you ask Chris Mack, he was most upset about today as far as execution goes. But other than that, Xavier did a lot of things well. I mean, you don't hold a team. You don't stay in the game for the first 10 minutes only scoring scoring 8 points yourself if you're not playing with some effort on the defensive end and some intensity. They did a good job in that regard. The three things that went wrong for them was, one, Stainbrook's injury, because one, it really, Gene Teague, I mean, he treated Kadeem Batts from Providence like a little child a couple nights ago. And he really humbled Jalen Reynolds quick for about six possessions in a row after Stainbrook went out of the game. Xavier couldn't make a shot. They got wide open looks all game. They knew exactly what they wanted to do against the zone. From the very beginning of the game, they were getting the ball to Samaje Christen at the free throw line and ran their offense almost exclusively through the middle of the court, which is exactly what you want to do against the zone. They got plenty of spray out threes from Samaje kicking it out. Guys just couldn't knock them down, and sometimes that happens. And heck, Samaje himself in the first half was like 2 for 8 from the field and couldn't finish a lot of shots around the rim that you expect him to make. And then three, I think Seton Hall had three seniors who really played well on their senior night. They played like it was the last game in front of their home crowd, despite that only being 6,000 people who don't really seem to care. But especially when you look at a guy like Brian Oliver, you don't expect to get beat by him. And part of that's on Xavier, but part of it's on, I mean, if a guy hits all those shots, he hits all those shots. You got to give him a little bit of credit. Gene Teague played exceptionally well. And Fuquan Edwin, coming off a thumb sprain, I thought played really well as well. So again, you kind of have a worst case scenario for Xavier when you combine all those three things, with Stainbrook getting injured, X not making any shots, and then Seton Hall having three seniors who played really well on their senior night.
Yeah, you mentioned those three guys. I mean, Edwin Teague and Oliver, you combine them, they had 54 points on the night of Seton Hall 71. They collectively were 13 of 18 from two and 6 of 13 from three. I mean, you can't do much better than that. Ominous signs for Xavier in this game. 3 of 22 from the three. I mean, I don't think it's possible to win a game shooting that poorly from the outside. And for whatever reason, Seton Hall just has some kind of juju or mojo going that makes Xavier brick wide open threes, because they're about 6 of 40 in the two games against the Pirates, and they're not that bad of a three-point shooting team elsewhere. The other problem, Rick, as I see, especially as we look forward to this Villanova game where Stainbrook's not going to be available, and we don't know to what extent Stainbrook will be available the rest the season, is that the Musketeer bench has just dropped off the face of the earth to a large extent, especially now we have to sort of assume that Jalen is a starter.
Sure.
So now you look at Miles Davis, who can't hit the broadside of a barn right now and looks just painfully slow trying to defend. James Farr, who has lost his rhythm from the three and continues to be a real liability defensively, and Brandon Randolph, who just never really has gotten it going this year. Then you add into the mix, you know, potentially an expanded role for Eric Stenger, who hasn't really been effective at all. I mean, that all of a sudden, the depth that Xavier had, which was an advantage for them earlier in the year, is a glaring problem for this team now.
Yeah, well, and Monahan on the board asked If Miles was still bothered by his knee. He said the guy moves like a 40-year-old. You just don't lose a shooting talent like that if you've had it your whole life, unless you're bothered by an injury of some sort. You mentioned his defense, Dan. I would agree with that most of the year. But I would ask you guys, and maybe I wasn't watching closely enough, and I need to go back and check the film, but how closely have you been watching him the last two games? Because the one thing I was thinking in this Seton Hall game was that even though he hasn't been making shots, which is what you would assume, if he's not making shots, you can't even have him out on the court. But in this case, I thought for the most part, he hasn't been a liability. Earlier in the year, it seemed like every team was attacking him, every possession that he was on the defensive end, trying to run a set play for whoever he was guarding to get him a bucket. And against Seton Hall, I mean, I just didn't see that. I saw him doing a fairly good job. I saw him showing good effort. He came up with a strip on one drive when Fuquan Edwin was working against Samaje. He helped out and got a strip. I think Miles has been doing better with the rest of the things, taking better care of the basketball, making good decisions, and defending. He's just got to make shots, and obviously it's frustrating to watch him miss them right now, but at the same time, I think to a man, every single person in Xavier's basketball program and inside the Cintas Center, if you ask them, they will tell you one thing they're not worried about is Miles Davis's ability to shoot.
Right, right. But I do think that one major issue, and I'm not as concerned about the backcourt, really. The issue now is that if you lose Stainbrook for any extended period of time, and, you know, obviously they're going to face a very good team on Thursday without him, you basically are going to have Isaiah Fillmore. You're going to have an inside rotation of Isaiah Fillmore, Jalen Reynolds, James Farr, and Eric Stanger. And that is a little bit frightening when you think about some of the guys that Villanova has, that St. John's, who probably will be X's opponent in the quarterfinal, is. Rosie from the message board asks, as we talk about what X is going to do without Stainbrook, how do you foresee the offense operating without Stainbrook? Will we see D. Davis handling the ball with Samaje attacking the high post, looking to shoot, drive, dish, or kick out to Martin? Another question was asked, I think we'll see Martin at the four, given the inexperience level of some of the backups that would be covering that 4 and 5 position.
Yeah, the answer is yes. I do think, to the second question, Martin is going to be playing the four like we saw last night a lot, especially against a team like Villanova, who has a more versatile stretch four type of lineup anyway. I mean, they have guys who are very mobile and move really well. So I think you'll see Justin Martin is actually, as we've seen, a very good rebounder, and he's a pretty strong guy when it comes to defending in the post. So it's obviously not like having a traditional post player defending in the post, but I think he can hold his own enough with a lot of the matchups in the Big East, where, quite frankly, we've seen mostly teams that are a little bit smaller and faster than X at the four position, to where I think in some ways that may benefit Xavier, especially when you look at a lineup of Justin Martin at the four and Jalen Reynolds at the five. I mean, you really become a much more athletic team that can defend. And I mentioned on Twitter last night that I think this might the press might be something. We saw it used effectively some. I mean, it gave up some easy buckets at the back end of it to Seton Hall, but at the same time, they were able to speed the Pirates up a little bit and cause some turnovers and get things going. And one, it helps their offense too. Without a guy like Stainbrook to play through on the offensive end, being able to speed things up with the press might help get their offense going. But the other problem with that is you run the risk of getting guys in foul trouble. So I really think it's only something we're going to see in the second halves of game. But I do think we'll see a lot of Martin at the four. The biggest issue I think that this presents is obviously rebounding. When Jalen Reynolds is in the game, I think they'll be fine on the glass. The question is, what happens when Jalen can only play 14 minutes because he's in foul trouble the whole time, or only 16 minutes because he's in foul trouble? They really need him to play 25 to 35 minutes every game that Stainbrook's not in from here on out. And that's asking a lot out of a guy who, quite frankly, has had trouble staying on the court because of foul issues. When it comes to Rosie's question about the offense, I think they're a little confused with what Xavier was doing to work against Seton Hall's zone last night with Samaje at the high post, and what they'll do in a man-to-man. I mean, against Villanova, they're going to run the same stuff they've been running, which is a lot of ball screen motion. In fact, this will work really well with more mobile guys and someone like Martin, who's going to be cutting and can pick and pop off of those screens as opposed to always diving to the rim. It's going to make them a little tougher to guard, I think, in the ball screen motion offense. I think they'll continue to run some of their passing game and their regular motion stuff as well that we've seen throughout the season some. And they'll continue to run a lot of set plays, which they've ran all year, to get, you know, dunks for Jalen Reynolds off the low screen across play that they've ran a lot, to free Samaje. Obviously, he'll be a huge focal point of the offense with Stainbrook going out. So hopefully that kind of answers the question about where the offense is going. I don't think it'll really change a whole lot. The only thing is they just won't be able to run through Stainbrook as much, where he's making a lot of passes out of the post, as we've seen him do recently, especially in the Creighton game.
Right. So Thursday night, Villanova, regular season finale. Musketeers sitting 10-7 right now in the Big East, 20-10 overall. Rick, the question now, I guess the mood now shifts to, what's the big picture? Where's Xavier as far as their NCAA tournament lives? Now, on the podcast last week, you said you thought Xavier needed one more win out of their last three games. I said I thought they needed, Snow and I both said we thought they needed two more wins, including the Big East tournament. The Muskies got a win against Creighton. Obviously, they stumbled against Seton Hall. But I think that the uncertainty arises because of the Stainbrook injury. had Matt Stainbrook been definitively out for the season, I think it would have really put a target on the Musketeers to prove that they could win a game before the NCAA tournament selection show without Matt Stainbrook in order to get into the field. How do you think Stainbrook's injury intersects with where the Musketeers are at this point? And how do you think Xavier will play that injury as far as, you know, in what they're going to release to the press, what's going to come out in order to avoid any negative effects?
Yeah, like we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, again, I think we're going to continue to hear that Matt Stainbrook is coming back, is on his way back. Coach Mack tossed out a timeline of 8 to 10 days for his physical therapy and how he responds from that. And everyone heals differently tonight in his coach's show. So they're definitely going to continue to float out this idea that Matt Stainbrook will be back at some point before the NCAA tournament for the selection committee.
I'm sure that 8 to 10 days, coincidentally, the quarterfinal of the Big East tournament is 9 days from today. Right, so exactly. I'm sure that the brackets are announced, I think, at 12 days from today. And the NCAA tournament starts in about 16 days or something like that. So there is a little bit of buffer here. So if Stainbrook does have the kind of injury that can be treated with 8 to 10 days of PT, theoretically, he could be back for the Big East tournament. But I do think they have to play it in somewhat of a canny way. They're going to avoid making any definitive statements, I think, because the NCAA selection committee over the years has proven that they do consider injuries to key players when they're making seeding decisions and decisions about teams that are in the tournament. I want to throw out a couple examples to you, Rick, because as you know, I'm a student of history. Probably the most notorious of all these is Kenyon Martin's leg injury in the 2000 and... Is it 1999? I think it was the 2000 Great West tournament against St. Louis, where UC was dropped, who had been number one in the polls all season long, was dropped to a 2 seed in the NCAA tournament because Martin was unavailable. Another example was when Robbie Hummel tore his ACL a couple years ago for Purdue, who at the time had been a top 3 team in the standings. They were dropped all the way to a 3 seed. Some examples of teams that actually saw their tournament hopes hurt by a big injury. One of your favorite players of all time, Patty Mills at St. Mary's, right, in 2009, suffered a broken foot about halfway through that season when the Gaels were 18-1. Now, that was a team, interestingly, because there's some deviation between them and Xavier this year. St. Mary's team had really played nobody all year. And after Mills got hurt, lost 4 West Coast Conference games, 2 of them to Gonzaga, which was no shame that year, but 2 of them to pretty bad teams, and then lost heavily in the West Coast Conference tournament after Mills returned. And as a result, they were left out of the NCAA tournament, despite having a respectable KenPom, respectable Sagarin, and having been pretty much unbeatable with Mills in the lineup, except for that one Gonzaga game. Another example that's kind of close to home is the 2006 UC team. That was the year that Andy Kennedy was the interim coach. And if you recall that year, I think it may have been one of UC's first years in the Big East. They were 8-8 in Big East play, 19-11 going into the Big East tournament. They had some big wins that year. They didn't really have a whole lot of terrible losses, but they had lost Armin Kirkland, who was a major contributor to them that year during the Big East season, one of their best defensive players. And as a result, when they lost on a last second shot to Syracuse in the Big East tournament, they ended up on the outside looking in, despite a KenPom ranking of 44, which is roughly where Xavier is right now. So there are some examples there of teams that have pretty good contributors that lost them on the eve of the NCAA tournament or for stretches that were crucial to their season. And the committee has looked at that and they've downgraded the team as a whole as a result of the unavailability of that player.
Yeah, the end of the day, X to me seemed to be in as maybe the last 10 seed or one of the first 11 seeds after the Saturday win over Creighton. This loss
at minimum, you mean? I mean, right. That was assuming no further wins.
Right. At that point, right then, that's what the resume said to me. If they lost out, this loss doesn't take them out of the tournament. What obviously muddies the picture is the injury to Stainbrook and how the committee views that, which is why we've talked so much about what Xavier's going to be saying in the next couple couple weeks about floating out there that Matt will be back. If they, if the committee buys that, then I think Xavier's still in the tournament, even without a win against Villanova or in the Big East tournament. But if you, the easy solution is you beat Villanova on Thursday with no Stainbrook, and none of this is a factor of all at all, because you've picked up another top 10 win without Stainbrook even playing, and the committee can't say anything about it at that point, whether he's available or not.
I guess my take is I think Xavier makes a tournament, provided they do not lose. They are not blown out twice. If they get blown out twice without Stainbrook, I think that they probably will miss the tournament. But if they keep it competitive against Villanova, especially on Thursday, if they keep it competitive against Villanova, and then they show, and then, you know, maybe they lose a close game to a St. John's, which is actually a road game in the Big East tournament, then maybe it doesn't hurt them as badly. I understand a little bit of the garment rending and the concern after the loss to Seton Hall, but I want to throw out a couple of things that I think are mitigating factors. First of all, each one of these games is only 3% of Xavier's season. Xavier's resume prior to the Seton Hall game was 93% plugged in. You know, these games at the end of the season, they feel like they're more significant because of recency bias, but the committee no longer considers how you finish. They no longer consider last 10, last 12, or at least it's not a stated part of a stated criterion for how they choose the teams. So this Seton Hall loss, yeah, it's bad, but it's not more significant than the Creighton win on Saturday. And it certainly does not take away the advantages of that Creighton win, because I think if you look back, the committee always focuses more on big wins, that will always value a big win more than a questionable loss. Secondly, Seton Hall, not that bad of a team. I mean, I know people are looking at their RPI and they're saying, oh, 144 in the RPI. Well, I think by this day and age, most people who are sophisticated in the way they follow basketball do not consider the RPI that important. And although some of the sort of quote unquote mainstream media writers make a big deal about the RPI and it's always on ESPN and so forth, the RPI, I think most people understand, is a flawed metric. And when you look at the KenPom ratings, Seton Hall is number 80 in the country. That's not that bad. I mean, when you look at the KenPom ratings, the only bad loss that Xavier has all season, and by bad loss, I mean team out of the top 100, is USC. Other than that, their losses are, you know, Seton Hall is about as bad as it gets at 80. So this is a team that doesn't have really that many bad losses, and they've got some big wins. You know, you look at Creighton, you look at a sweep over St. John's, who's 40 in the KenPom rankings. You look at the UC win. You look at the split with Tennessee. There are quite a few good things happening on this resume. And although there are holes, the road neutral record is not great. You would have liked to have seen them win.
That's on the bubble. But that's the one thing about that. I looked through all of them today, and there's no one with an impressive road record that's on the bubble right now.
Right. And I would just encourage people to go on KenPom.com if you have a subscription, or go on the RPI websites or whatever, and look at some of these teams that Xavier is being ranked close to, let's say on the bracket matrix. Look at the resume of a team like Cal or Brigham Young or Minnesota or Arkansas or Mizzou or even Pitt. These resumes are not definitively better than Xavier, and those are all other teams that, according to the bracket matrix, are in as of now. Right. The first four out on the bracket matrix are Providence, Tennessee, Florida State, and St. John's. Well, we know St. John's, Xavier beat them twice. You know, Florida State has beaten very few teams of note this year. Tennessee is a decent team, and I think that they will end up making the tournament because I think they'll get some wins in the SEC tournament. But Providence, do you really think that Providence's resume is better than Xavier's? Because I don't. And then you look further down the list, and it's like in Nebraska, who has some nice road wins but hasn't done much other than that. Dayton, Georgetown, you know, I mean, Richmond is in the mix. I mean, these are the teams that Xavier is in direct conflict with. And they really aren't that impressive. All of them have flaws. Another thing that you and I talked about off air, Rick, that plays in Xavier's favor this year is that this is a year that is very much devoid of quality mid-major type teams that are going to be in position to get a bid to the tournament, even if they don't win their conference tournament. think about teams like a Belmont in previous years. This year, you've got Wichita State, who obviously at 31-0 is going to be probably a number one seed in the tournament, even if they lose in the Valley Conference tournament. So that's one where a bid could be sniped. But who else, really? I mean, is it Gonzaga? Then maybe there's a huge gap to Wisconsin Green Bay, who I don't think is going to make the tournament if they fail to win the Horizon League. So I don't see as many teams popping up to snipe bids this year as maybe you would see in the past.
No, I agree. And in part of that, you know, part of what's helping too is that the conferences like the Atlantic 10 and the AAC have pretty definitive lines, I think, this year of teams that are definitely in. And so you look at it and it's like, man, those teams that are definitely in, one of those four or five are probably definitely going to win their conference tournament. You know, I mean, when you look at both of those two conferences, those are two that I look at where it's like they're probably not going to screw things up, because you have four or five teams that are definitely in the tournament and four or five teams who are out of them. One of them will probably definitely win the conference tournament.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and the thing to remember as you're worrying yourself about that loss to Seton Hall or the impending loss in the Big East tournament if Xavier doesn't win it, keep in mind that, you know, there's about 318 other teams in college basketball that are going to suffer a loss next week. And those that don't are automatically in the tournament. So there's a lot of there are so many data points that are still out there to be thrown into the mix that, you know, concerning yourself with what if the season ended today is not worthwhile. The teams that are on the bubble are going to have additional blemishes to their record by the time the decisions are made regarding seeding. Yep. So I think the Musketeers will make the tournament. I think they'll make the tournament, as I said, provided they don't get completely blown out by both Villanova and St. John's, if that's who they play in the Big East tournament. But
yep,
I really don't think there are that many teams that are that upwardly mobile to move past where Xavier is right now.
I agree. And that's where my biggest thought, that even if Xavier loses these next two games, they lose at Villanova and they lose at home against Villanova and they lose in the first round of the Big East tournament, I still think there's a decent chance that they get in, provided the selection committee doesn't crush them for Stainbrook potentially being out. I mean, if he returns for the Big East tournament, then I think they're definitely in no matter what happens. But I do kind of agree with you. I mean, if you go out there, you lose by 20 to Villanova, you lose by 20 to St. John's at Madison Square Garden, and Stainbrook doesn't play in either game, then yeah, you're probably very nervous come selection Sunday.
And then the NCAA tournament committee could show a great sense of humor and make Xavier play Dayton in the first four.
Yeah. Or the other matchup that I saw in one of the bracketologists, and I can't remember who it was today, had Xavier as an 11 playing Kentucky as a 6 in Milwaukee, which, God, that would be fantastic.
Can I ask you a question, Rick?
Yeah.
We just saw John Calipari get thrown out of the game against South Carolina last weekend. Why was Calipari's entire shirt tail untucked when he was thrown out of the game? He looked like the biggest slob. For a guy that usually looks relatively dapper, he looked like a complete slob at that point. He looked like he was
Billy G after a good Saturday night.
Well, speaking of, we're going to move away from the Muskies at this point. Obviously, season ends on Thursday night against Villanova, 7 o'clock tip, Cintas Center, standing room only tickets available. I think it's a sellout, but I think there are some standing room only tickets that are still available. Should be another great atmosphere. And, you know, obviously if the Muskies can pull that one out, you know, you can throw away the last 15 minutes of our dialogue, but, we'll be back. But next week, when we come back, we'll preview the Big East tournament at Madison Square Garden,
which we'll be attending.
We may actually be there at the time. Mm-hmm. And we'll also talk a little bit about senior night and some of the guys that are departing the program at this point. But at this stage, Rick, you wanted to talk about you wanted to exchange some hot sports takes, which is difficult to do since Snow isn't here.
Right.
Because usually I just huddle around the heat of his takes like a homeless guy around a barrel. But
well, obviously the big thing that happened over the weekend in college basketball was the Mick Cronin versus Teddy Valentine exchange. And it's funny because there's so many different reactions to this. And I go in two different directions on it, sort of. And the first thing was, I think Teddy Valentine was completely out of line. And I think Mick was well within his rights the way that he acted towards Teddy Valentine. Now, if you want to get into him shoving Larry Davis and yelling at Justin Jackson for trying to hold him back, that's completely different, and that's up to you. But I thought the way he reacted to Teddy Valentine was fine. Teddy Valentine, Mick was over on his sideline, not out on the court. He was simply with his hands down asking about who the ball went out of bounds on, and Valentine jumped into his face and started screaming, which there's never an excuse for. So that's where I stand on that. And I don't necessarily disagree when Mick says things like, if you jump in someone's face, you know, you can't do that where I come from, type of thing. Hear me out on this. I feel like that's kind of how I would feel too. Like, if someone jumps into my face while I'm coaching, I probably would have reacted the exact same way. You would have held me back and I would have been going nuts on whoever the official was. But now the funny part of this whole thing is, this is why you can't act the way Mick Cronin did after the post crosstown shootout press conference. This is why you can't say things like, it's just a game. This is bigger than the players. They need to get over themselves. We're representing institutions of higher learning. My college is developing cures for Benadryl and cancer. There's more important things. You need to get over yourselves. There's no excuse for this. You can't act like that. The administration will never have to worry about the things that are right while I'm the coach of this university. That's why you don't say stupid things like that at a press conference and throw your players under the bus, because all of a sudden now when you do it, your comment to the press is, well, where I come from, people can't jump in your face and you don't get to react. There's a complete double standard for the way Mick treats himself and his players.
Well, first of all, Mick went to LaSalle. Come on, man.
Right. GCL toughness.
I went to a GCL school.
Toughness.
Nobody was getting in anyone's face. Come on, man. It's not like you grew up in Avondale. Let's get serious. Let's start out there. You know, you didn't grow up on the mean streets of Sycamore Township with snow.
Or Latonia. Right.
Anyhow. I thought that Justin Jackson was the MVP of this entire thing. I thought he showed great senior leadership to pick up his coach and bodily carry him down the. I give a lot of credit to actually to I and I actually do give credit to Justin Jackson there, because that was a very close game, and the last thing that UC needed at that point was a technical foul. And you know, Teddy Valentine in a certain way by reacting so aggressively to Cronin probably took the possibility of calling a technical out away from himself.
Yeah, he knew he was screwed up. That's the problem. Teddy knew he had screwed up and he couldn't call a tech at that point.
You know, Teddy's one of those guys across college basketball that's just got kind of that reputation that, I mean, he's one of those officials that people are like, well, if everybody complains about the guy so much, how does he still get work? But
Mick and Teddy are friends, though. That's the thing. Like, they go back. Like, they're really tight. And Mick knew what he was doing. And that's why you saw him stroke Teddy's ego in the postgame press conference by saying he's a great official. I'm glad I have him in my conference now. I wish he would have been in the Big East. Mick knows what he's doing. He's going to own Teddy for the next 2 years. I guarantee you that.
All right. So now we can talk about our brief interaction with Teddy Valentine during a game last year. Now it can finally be told. The statute of limitations has expired. Rick and I are sitting at the scores table at Cintas during the Kent State game last year, I want to say.
Yeah, I think it was.
And we've got Mike Babinski on the one side and OZ Davis, who's a legendary figure here in Cincinnati, on the other side. And OZ keeps up a pretty good patter during the game, talking about the different players. He knows everybody. He knows all the guys from Cincinnati. He knows their parents. He knows their family, whatever else. Samaje has a rough half in the first half. And Samaje gets the ball stolen from him. They come down the other end. His man crosses him over, walks at the free throw line and hits a jump shot. Teddy ignores it. OZ says something like, man, that's a walk, like way louder than you usually would say something at the press table, because those guys can hear you on the floor, as it turns out.
Right. Not to mention there's signs at each press row spot saying, you know, no cheering.
You're right.
Bickering with the refs, anything like that. But
rules don't apply to Teddy. Teddy turns around and he's pissed, and he's looking directly at me. And I think he thinks that I said it. And so my initial reaction, Ted Valentine's a big dude.
Meanwhile, there's just a puddle forming on the floor next to me.
Right. So I'm thinking to myself, man, I would rather be anywhere but here right now. And finally, Ozzy kind of takes responsibility for it. And so instead of the, you know, 30-year-old punk sitting there with a laptop, it's all of a sudden the sort of jovial looking older African-American gentleman next to me. And all of a sudden, Teddy's a little bit more at ease. So Ozzy is embarrassed, of course, and he's looking at us and like giving us the eye. So right before halftime, he sneaks off so he doesn't get called on the carpet. And then at halftime, Teddy comes back over to where you and I are sitting, and he's like, "Where's your guy? Where's your guy? I need to talk to him." And so Ozzy had made a quick retreat, I think under the pretense of having to go to the bathroom, but they were BSing in the second half. But it was kind of funny. I don't think I've ever been that frightened at a basketball game in my entire life, because I thought I was going to be thrown out and
by Teddy Valentine. Well, there were so many times where Mike Babinski isn't here anymore. So, you know, he's at Georgia Tech. I don't think he'd care at all that I tell this now. So I'm going to go ahead and tell this. I remember specifically, you remember when Kenny Freeze, it seemed like when they had just implemented that new like elbow rule. No matter what, if you touch someone in the head with an elbow, it's a technical or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And Kenny got called for like three of them within the first week of the season, like two in the exhibitions and then one in the first regular season game. And all of them were like questionable, where he was literally just turning around and guys are literally at the size of, you know, where his elbows are naturally turning. And so he's getting called for these fouls. And Mike Babinski is just livid about this. So finally he tells one of these officials that he's like, "That's not the effing intent of the rule. That's not the effing intent. You're effing this up. You're effing this up." And I am 100% certain that they're not going to turn around and throw out the athletic director that is in the suit. They're going to throw out the idiot from Musketeer.
The chairman of the NCAA selection committee, too.
Right, right. I'm convinced that they're going to go ahead and throw out, you know, the idiot from Musketeer Report with the sweater on. And but fortunately, you know, Babinski always held it down over there and kept me from getting thrown out on his behalf. So I appreciated that.
Rick, let's just we'll leave UC alone after this. But, you know, you've seen a little bit of a soft underbelly from them in a couple of their recent games. The SMU loss, the UConn loss. What do you think their seed line is going to look like, given some of the weakness of their non-conference schedule?
Well, I think the one thing that is going to make a big difference is how these AAC teams finish up, because I think when you look at a lot of them, they've got a good resume, especially like wins over Louisville is obviously great for UC. But I think a lot of them aren't great because they have so many of those 150 plus RPI teams in their conference, four of them, I think, within the Americans. So I think that will play into it. How do these teams finish? Can they avoid an upset in their conference tournament? And if they don't do that, then they could see their seed line slip for sure.
I think their upside is, I think they have the upside if they beat Memphis and they sweep through the AAC tournament, especially if they beat Louisville, of potentially getting a two seed. But I think more likely they're probably in the four zone.
I think they could slide down to a five. You know, I could see them still dropping another seed line if they don't avoid an upset in their conference tournament.
I don't know. I mean, the part of the problem is that UC is kind of at the bottom of what I would say is the first tier of teams in college basketball this year, because when you look at the teams that are below them, like on an S curve, like on a model S curve, and you're looking at teams like Kentucky, Texas, UCLA, Ohio State, Oklahoma, there's a pretty substantial drop there between a team of UC's quality and those teams.
Those teams, but there's also Louisville, who's now seated as a five right behind them, who could win their conference's tournament. And if that happens and UC gets upset in the first round, I could easily see those two flopping. So I agree with you that they're four with the potential to move up to a three if they make a nice little run or even win the conference tournament. But I could still see them sliding down to even a five if they don't avoid an upset.
All right, Rick, I think the last topic that we wanted to hit on during today's show, and we appreciate everybody's patience with us. We're trying to do a quick turnaround before the Villanova game. The Big East schedule makers didn't really help us this week. Is the comments by Bob Castellini in the MLB.com article that came out this week with Mark Sheldon. I believe that was who it was. It was with John Fay in the Enquirer, I thought. But either way, he made some comments that you took some exception to.
Well, I just, you know, his statement was basically, actually, hold on, I've got the article right here. I can actually just read his quote. Was that, so when you guys start writing right during the caravan about the money, the fact that we didn't add any guys. Well, we had all these guys hurt, Castellini said. We knew we wanted to sign Homer Bailey. We knew we were going to make some other commitments. It's not that we didn't look. It gets written in such a way, well, the Reds aren't doing anything. That really does affect people buying season tickets. Personally, I get a little ticked off. And what his point was that the media has cost the Reds the opportunity to sell out their targeted goal of 13,000 to 14,000 season tickets before the season starts. And first of all, here's my thing on this. Who are the Reds PR people? Because they're better at their jobs than this usually. I think the Reds has a really good PR staff. And I guess this Castellini just talking off the cuff, which is never a good thing. But they've got to know that this never looks good. Complaining like this about why you can't sell tickets or why your product isn't good is never a good look. Whether you're blaming fans or you're blaming the media, it's never going to come off as anything other than whining. If you want to sell your allotment of season tickets, make a move in the offseason. You didn't do that. That's not the media's fault. They get paid to talk about roster composition. That is what they do. That's what they're going to continue to do. And yes, a lot of people are phrasing it as, well, the Reds aren't doing a whole lot. But it's not just the local media doing this. It's not the guys getting paid $30,000 to cover your beat for MLB.com that are doing this. It's national media that are saying this about you, too. You're a team that was under a microscope coming out of last season because you kind of underachieved with the way things finished. You're a team that still has that kind of window with a couple superstars like Joey Votto and a great pitching staff, pitching rotation that could maybe challenge the Cardinals at the top of the Central and be a contender in the National League if you possibly made a move in the offseason. You didn't improve your team. So that is going to be a topic that the media talks about. It's not on the media to sell your season tickets. That's not their job. And to claim that and to whine about it just comes off. It's never a good look. I just hate that.
I think that there is a lot of truth to what you're saying. I think that asking the local media to serve as PR mouthpieces for your team is not really a legitimate request. I also think that one thing in this country that we have a nasty habit of is rich people telling poor people what they should do with their money. it's something that always amuses me. But you know, season tickets are what they are, and that's a huge driver for revenue. But the weird thing about what Castellini is saying is that, first of all, attendance for the Reds has increased every year since 2009, and last year was over 30,000 a game. I think they either broke the record or they came very close to the franchise record in attendance. I would certainly expect it to be similar this year. I mean, you know, really, attendance is not an issue. And I think, honestly, given the sizes of this market, given the challenges that people have of getting to games, especially on the weeknights, if you don't live in Cincinnati because of traffic or because of kids or whatever, I think 31, 32, 33,000 in a 40,000 seat stadium might be about the maximum that's reasonable to expect. The revenue generation for the Reds is going to come from the media deals. And that's been the biggest place that they put the way they've positioned themselves the whole time. So I don't know why Castellini felt like he had to do this, except maybe just general frustration that people were judging the Reds so harshly on this offseason. I think his faith in some of the guys returning from injury is maybe a little misplaced. I don't think that the Reds could afford to just stand pat this offseason and assume that they would return to the form they showed in 2012. But I'm not going to – but, you know, Bob Castellini has been, on the whole, an extremely good owner for this city. And, you know, if he's a super competitive guy, he's also the kind of guy that is not real patient. And so I can understand why he's a little bit frustrated with the way maybe that this offseason has been perceived, because I do believe him that the Reds have really been trying to make aggressive moves and the deals just haven't been there, because, you know, I don't see why the Reds would consider, because the Reds really don't have a whole lot of assets that they can move right now. And as a result, making a deal that wouldn't hamstring the franchise down the road is a risk. So I guess I don't view it as bad, but I do understand your point that, you know, we shouldn't be expecting the media to just kowtow and walk the company line about whatever you want to talk about.
Well, and even if you do want that, go to the media and send a message. Don't make your players as available. I mean, if that's something, you know, if you want to punish the media and it's not going to work in your favor, because ultimately that's going to backfire too. But why would you ever complain in the public to your fans? I mean, letting your fans hear this again just comes off as whiny to me, and I just think it's a bad PR move. And the other thing is, let's face it, what I think he's really frustrated about is the fact that they've gone out and paid a ton of money the last couple of years to bring or to keep Homer Bailey, Brandon Phillips, Joey Votto to these massive contracts. And I think he wants a little more positive publicity for that, instead of people looking around going, well, what are you going to do for us? And what are you going to add to this team to make it better? And he's going, well, wait a minute, we're re-signing all these guys, we are better. And, you know, people expect more than that, which, again, that's not the media's fault. That is part of the story right now. I mean, that's how it's going to be covered. There's no, and again, I think the other thing that I dislike about it is what you said. You've seen your attendance increase the last few years. The fans are doing their part. Why say something that sounds whiny, like we're not selling enough tickets? The fans are doing their part right now. They're supporting you. Continue winning and the fans will do their job. That's always been the case in Cincinnati.
All right, Rick, anything else you want to touch on, or are we ready to walk off into the sunset for this probably last edition of the podcast? Well, the last edition of the podcast of the regular season, but maybe the last to be recorded in the tri-state area until the NCAA tournament?
Okay, I'm really looking forward to podcasting inside Madison Square Garden, though. Whether we record a whole podcast or at least just some interviews inside of there, we're definitely going to say we podcasted in Madison Square Garden. I know that much.
Rick, what are you most looking forward to doing other than going to the basketball games in New York City? Have you charted out sort of what your cultural schedule is going to look like next week?
Dan, that's why I'm traveling with you. Like, you're supposed to bring the culture to this. My culture is the basketball. What I'm excited to see is Madison Square Garden. I'm confident that you have other reasons you'd like to go to New York, but I'm there for pretty much one reason, and I will be happy to eat as well. I do that really, really well. So I'll be more than happy to follow you around, eat, and read whatever historical plaques you can point out to me.
I'm really good at eating and drinking. So those are two things that I look forward a great deal in New York, which I hear is good. And I hear you can do both there.
Yeah.
And have a pretty good time. So this is the 47th edition, which is the what day did I say it was? February 8th, 2003, I think, the David West 47-19 edition. 47 also, I think, the combined number of beers my dad and I had that day, as nice. I recall.
All right. Well, for Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.